It's Wednesday, January 17th, 2007, and you're listening to episode 35 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 53 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan, and on the mics today is Adam.
That's right.
Chad.
Howdy.
And John.
Yo.
All right, now what is it with you guys changing seats every episode?
Let me paint this picture for you. For about 20 episodes in this show, I didn't say much. And I thought it was because, generally, I don't speak as well as everybody else in this podcast. But, oh no, there's an extra cause. It is the cursed chair that I have moved away from.
Cursed chair, my hairy white ass. I'm sitting in this so-called cursed chair right now, and we'll see if it has anything to do with...
Last episode, Chad fell asleep during the podcast.
It was awful. I always thought he was full of it. He's like, cursed chair, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And I always talk a lot during these episodes and stuff. Last two episodes, I just sat there. I'm like, it was awful.
What exactly is the chair's curse?
It puts you to sleep.
It's awful.
It's a lethargy. You can't concentrate.
It's just terrible.
Yeah.
Chad, I think if we did the Chad to everyone else pie chart for the last two episodes, it would still be about 50-50.
Along with all the rest of them.
Don't you?
No, I didn't say too much.
The only thing that he said last time was about the moth.
Yeah.
Oh.
And then after the moth story was done, I don't think he said anything else for the rest of the podcast.
Because I was asleep. The chair knocked me unconscious.
Well, we'll see. I've already got my nap today since I entered Dan's basement.
So. Yeah, 5 minutes ago.
I should be all right. Yeah, 5 minutes ago.
All right. Before the show, we were over at Chili's, and you guys were telling me that there's something you need to talk about on the podcast today that involves Phil's infamous tongue finger.
Yes.
Okay, what is this all about?
As you know, we have a official Fear the Boot WoW Guild on World of Warcraft, of all things, being a WoW Guild and no less. Black Hand server, Alliance side, if anyone wants to join. Anyway, I got this tell the other day, and this guy named Tongue Finger sends me a tell, and he's like, dude, I listened to your podcast. I'm a huge fan. Can you get me in the guild? And I'm like, can I ever? Tongue Finger? Like, that is the greatest name ever. And he's like, yeah, I know.
We'll triple the number of ladies in no time.
I saw him on the roster yesterday, and I was like, oh, that's funny. One of my jackass co-hosts made an alt. Oh, no.
No.
This is a new guy.
This is definitely an individual person who just came into Tongue Finger of his own volition. I almost made him an officer right on the spot. I don't know.
He can have my officer spot.
Greatest name ever.
Someone on our forums, someone being specifically our forum user, iTyrant, posted a link to Ryan Dancy's predictions for the role-playing industry in 2007. And if you don't know who Ryan Dancy is, because I didn't either until I went and looked it up, he used to be the head of the RPG division over at Wizards of the Coast. None of us here on the show really keep up with the industry very well.
I hang on his every word.
Yeah, so my first thought when I read this was, Ryan Dancy who? I was like, is this the guy that wrote the Megatrends 2000 book? but it is about on that level. He writes a series of predictions for the industry in 2007 that are all pretty powerfully doom and gloom. It starts off, he lists what he considers the six big game makers in the market, which is Wizards of the Coast, Upper Deck, which he thinks will enter the game market. They don't currently make games.
Oh, yeah.
They do CCGs, though, right?
Yeah, they do some
baseball
cards.
Well,
yeah, going way back.
Baseball cards,
right.
Yeah.
Well, they're the ones that do the World of Warcraft card game.
Oh, my God. They could do baseball card CCGs.
Oh, my God.
Albert Pujols versus Charizard. Winner Pujols.
Yeah, because he's got a bat.
Yeah.
But Upper Deck, which, like I said, doesn't make games yet, but he's guessing they will soon because they're headed that direction. Games Workshop, Privateer Press, WizKids, and White Wolf. It's kind of a lot of blah, 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 but his final conclusion is he thinks that by the end of the year, one or two of them may have done well, but for the most part, the market in general is going to turn down. And he also, in fact, goes so far as predicting that one of them is going to go bankrupt by the end of 2007. And doesn't
yeah,
list,
it's called Steve Jackson Games.
Doesn't list.
They started bankrupt.
We're talking about cash, not moral bankruptcy.
Dan at feartheboot.com.
You can send them to John, too. I'll stand by it.
Nice.
And he also goes on to talk about how he thinks that there's going to be a continued uptick in the collectible mini and card games over the role-playing games.
I wouldn't doubt that at all.
All right, now here's my series of questions on this. One of the first things that occurred to me when I looked at this...
It's the end of role-playing games as we know it.
Don't worry, SOG isn't produced by any of those. We're all good.
Yeah. Excellent.
I used to be peripherally involved with a radio show that talked about comic books. And I remember when I was working with them that they had several conversations that I myself am not a big comic book aficionado, so I really couldn't tell you a whole lot about the industry. But they were talking about how they saw all these problems with comic books, where comics used to be a really big industry, that this is what every kid did.
Yeah.
But as of the past 20-ish years or whatever,
it's dying.
It has steadily gone down and down and down. And they're having real trouble bringing in new blood, and all the time they're losing old blood to other forms of entertainment because they just can't keep up with things like television and video games.
You know, if you rent the movie The Crow,
right,
DVD, there is an interview on that DVD with Stan Lee, and they don't talk about The Crow at all in this interview. And they talk about the state of comic books, and it's that exact conversation that they're having that you just said. And he details why American comic books, the readership has gone downhill, and the types of things that at least Marvel is trying to do to get new readers back. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and I guess when I was reading this, kind of the first thing that hit my mind was, do I believe what he's saying? And it's like, even if I don't know if I quite agree with all of his details, because he talked around a few what I think are really important points that I'll bring up here in a second. But that aside, I've seen this since even the 90s. I mean, I remember back 10, 15 years ago that role-playing games were a lot bigger than they were now. And then you had TSR went under, FASA went under, and most of them said they were going under because their market penetration was either getting more shallow or at the very best it was remaining stagnant, mm-hmm. which was not enough for them to really do anything with the business. What do you guys think of this? Just before we get into details,
I'm not gonna say bankruptcy, but I mean, continue the trend of the decline. Yeah, probably.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, 10, 15 year old kid picks up gaming as a hobby. Does he go to D&D or Warcraft? Well, 95 plus times out of 100, it's Warcraft.
The way I see it, it's a matter of a pie. It's back in the 80s. You only had And even the 70s, you had a very limited amount of competition when you talked about the niche market of a role-playing game. So a role player, a gamer, had in his wallet plenty of money to buy gaming books because there wasn't a lot of competition for that dollar just among role-playing games. But as time goes on, I mean, your typical gamer is into a lot of things. I mean, look at this demographic sitting around this table here. What are we all into that is dorky and gaming? We're into gaming. We're into war miniature gaming. Some of us have been or into CCGs, comic books. All the comic books were around in the 70s, of course. Different video games and stuff. Movies. Well, you know, movies were around back then, too. But I don't know. Like I said, it's just a lot of pulling money out of your wallet for our... dorky sort of thing.
I think that's completely true. In fact, one of the big points I was going to bring up that he missed is he talks about the competition for that dollars, never mentions video games.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the biggest things that is just jackhammering the industry right now is the fact that people are spending more money and more time on electronic entertainment than they are mm-hmm. on paper entertainment. Because you have hit a point now where the vast majority of homes out there that have disposable income also have a computer yeah. and or at least one video game
That's
console.
Absolutely true. I remember one of the episodes Tex was on, or perhaps it was a forum post. He works for Xbox, of course, and he said that they don't see themselves as competing with Nintendo and Sony, period. They see themselves as competing with anything else you can buy to entertain yourself. And I think the RPG publishers need to pick up that mentality or ignore it at their peril.
I want to read a quote from his article, and then I want to kind of throw out here just sort of a personal anecdote of my journey through RPGs and tell you how this strikes me. He says, quote, "In 2007, the market consists of three major categories, in order of volume and revenue, trading games, miniature games, role-playing games." All right, so once again, in order of volume and revenue, so biggest to smallest, trading card games, miniature games, role-playing games. And let me tell you that I think, and he just says this in passing and moves on. It is my opinion that statement right there is part of the problem. And let me explain this from two angles. We have active on our forums a couple guys that either own or work at gaming stores. For example, there's a chain of stores called Clicks here in the St. Louis area, and the guy that owns that chain is on the forum. One of the things these people have talked about is what is really killing them is the cost of stocking a lot of the current fads. And specifically what he goes after is the miniature games and to a lesser extent the card games, because with D&D, you stock a handful of books and kind of a smattering of source books
that could last you forever
in a small little section of shelf space, and you're ready to sell. And but with a miniature game, you have to go out and you have to buy up front the box sets, the army sets, oodles and oodles and oodles of blisters.
And then also the periphery stuff, too, like the paints, the glues, the knives.
Exactly. And you spend a massive amount of money up front stocking huge amounts of shelf space with no idea that any of it is necessarily going to move or what people are going to want. And this really eats into the margin that they're making off of
these games. And WotC also doesn't demand that you buy all the supplement books if you just want to have a player's handbook and a Dungeon Master's Guide. Yeah. Games Workshop does. If you stock Warhammer, you got to stock all of it.
Games Workshop also demands minimum orders. Like, you must order, I don't know the numbers, I don't run a shop, but you must order like $1,000 worth of stuff. Mm. And when you get resupplies, whether you need an item or not, you have to buy certain items out of the restock. But that's Games Workshop that does that. Other miniature companies don't do that. Like Privateer Press doesn't do that to their
retailers. Here comes the Privateer Press shill.
Ah. All right, let me go back at that same comment here from a different angle. And this is where I'm going to get back kind of to an anecdote of where I've come in my life as a gamer. We have said many times on the show, including once within this episode, that we don't do a good job of keeping up with the market. And I don't know that we have ever explained in this show why that is. And so let me tell that story now. And if we have said this before, forgive us because our new folks may be walking through this for the first time.
I'll go quick and just say it's because I'm lazy and really don't care. But anecdote.
Well, you know, actually, in a way, though, that's kind of where I'm getting at. But let's explain why I don't care. When I first got into gaming, it was in the very late 80s. I was first roped in. Actually through the Crescent Hawks Inception video game.
Oh, great game.
But it came with a FASA catalog, I believe.
and we have gone on and on about the wonderfulness of the FASA catalog.
And from that FASA catalog, I got into the Star Trek role-playing game, from the Star Trek role-playing game to Shadowrun, Shadowrun to Battletech, and then eventually into D&D and on into other things.
I'll never forget, the first character I made was for that very Star Trek game he's talking about.
3 hours.
Three-hour
character creation.
3 hours, Tex and myself, and you were cutting the grass in your backyard.
Old men musing about the past.
Yeah.
That's right.
It was a push mower. This was back before gasoline. And,
actually, that's really what I'm interested in this story.
The lawn mowing.
Yeah.
So anyway, you know, I got really into role-playing games, and I followed the market very carefully through the mid to maybe a little bit into the later 90s. And at the time, I mean, I was avid about it. I'd read the FASA catalogs. I would read the TSR catalogs. I could actually identify some of the people in the industry and what it is they did and the roles they held in various companies. I didn't have a subscription to Dragon Magazine, but I had friends that did, and I would flip through their Dragon magazines. At the time, I was even writing for the Battletech fan magazine. My brother and I used to co-write a series of articles for them. And I really knew what was going on. But then I noticed that there was a change in the entire industry where it seemed like through most of my time role-playing, yeah, a certain percentage of the market was the youngerish kids, the junior high, early high school. But most of the really kind of main focus point of the role-playing industry was your college-age kids, young adults. And the games were written that way, and this is who was buying them, and this is who was playing them. And I noticed that there was a change, and I first saw this in Battletech, but I saw it in general, where it seemed like the what was being written in the role-playing games was going down in quality, and specifically going down in quality in that it was becoming more and more mature. That you could tell suddenly these games were playing less like reenactments of World War II and more like a Saturday morning cartoon. And I just completely lost my taste for these things, and it seemed like really the final nails that were driven in that coffin was when Magic the Gathering came out, and suddenly the market took yet another turn further away from deeper role-playing and better thought-out products just into these quick-kill, flood-the-market products. And
when do you think that that is because of Magic the Gathering, or that
no,
that
I think,
it just happened alongside?
I think Magic the Gathering was a symptom, because we actually had a series of talks with the guys that were like running FASA about this. We did, and then there was also a girl we knew by the name of Camille Klein, who was fairly vocal, kind of BattleTech type activist. And we all had multiple
BattleTech activist. How do I get that job?
Dude, she started something called the Church of BattleTech. Do a search online. She was actually a pretty funny girl. It was all very tongue in cheek. But we started talking to him about it, said, wait a minute, you guys are destroying your own base, because they were complaining, look, the market's stagnant, we're not growing. And it's, we understand that. We follow what your guys' problem is. But as you make these products more mature, yeah, you may bring in a flood of money from the 13-year-old crowd. But what happens is, like every other fad that comes and goes on the schoolyard, you are going to get a flood of money because this is the next big thing. But then suddenly, a year from now, they've forgotten all about it and they've moved on to something else.
Whereas real BattleTech players have stuck with it
for years.
For years and years.
And this is, in fact, exactly what happened. They released the cartoon, they came out with the toys from Glue. Ugh. And I think Magic the Gathering was a symptom of this. I mean, look at, for example, just let's take the Pokemon card game, the Yu-Gi-Oh card game. Just how big these trading card games have become on the playground. Mm. And sure, these people have made a ton of money, but these products do not have a real generational staying power.
I don't know about that. Pokemon cards have been around for a damn long time, and as far as I'm aware, they're still selling.
Sure, and so was Magic Card for a while.
Listen, Magic the Gathering gave us something beautiful. The game came out, and several decades later, on our forum, people made Magic the Gathering cards for each of the hosts, and I got a hearty chuckle.
Well, I think that was only one decade, but I got a chuckle too.
But here the nuance that I'm sticking into this. I'm not saying these things come and go in the course of a month. They may stick around for a while. But if you compare how long D&D has been around for and how long it will be around for versus how long Magic was during its heyday, or versus probably how long Pokemon will be into the future, there's just a complete gap between the life cycle of these products. I realize Pokemon's a big fad, has been here for a little while, and probably will be for a while longer. But I just have trouble seeing this as being the kind of thing that it 5 years from now will be as big as it was at its peak a couple years ago. But I mean, even if you disagree with me on that, the broader point here still is that they switched the nature of the products they were making over to these things that were meant more
from
to be quick
high
fads.
Quality.
You mean from longevity to fad?
Yeah, exactly.
I would rather sell a trillion units at once than sell 10 units a year for 10 years.
I agree.
You
That's
know, but
better business.
And it is.
And well, and from the standpoint of the individual publisher, that's logic I can't argue with.
Yeah.
But ultimately,
we're not saying
in the
wrong.
End,
we're just saying they're making bad games.
Yeah, exactly. And in the end, what that does, you lose the people that were there for the fad, and you've alienated the people like us that were in there for the long haul. And this is what has driven us now to the point where really all we do anymore
is podcast and bitch.
Well, we play
make our own games.
We make our own games and play a lot of the old ones. There's not much on the shelf right now that would interest me.
Well,
I realize there are some gems out there, but
there's no demanded obsolescence of D&D 2nd Edition. I can pick it up and play it right now. I can't walk into a Magic card store with my Psychotog deck from the Weatherlight Saga or whatever the hell it was from, because it's out now. All those cards, unless they've been renamed, are useless. And I think that's a lot of the reason why these minis and these cards keep selling, because you have to buy them over and over and over again.
Let's move from this into the future, because we've talked a little bit about why, you know, what this guy said, and if you guys are interested in reading the article, it's linked on our forums. You can find it from there. Send me an email and I'll send you a link to it. But, you know, reading his predictions over, they're all pretty doom and gloom. And I've tried to throw in here a few things that I think he missed about why the industry's in trouble. But let's talk about what could be done to save it. And I realize that this now we're getting into that golden BB that everyone is searching for. People that are paid to think about this a whole lot longer and harder than we are is looking for this answer. What do you think saves the industry?
Do you want the hippie response? Because the hippie response is, well, make games that revolutionize the industry and draw new people into the market.
No,
but that's unrealistic.
I don't think that that's it, because I think that the games that will revolutionize the industry, so to speak, those are your indie games. Those are the people who have nothing to lose and an emotional investment in the hobby.
Well, by revolutionize, I mean change the current state of the industry, which is stagnant.
It may not just be indie games. I mean, one of the things he mentions in his article is that the World of Darkness brought in a slightly different demographic than the typical gamer, which was really, I guess, sort of a goth crowd or maybe a little bit more.
And then
of a,
very tragically, we assimilated them into our culture and now they're here.
Yeah, or I guess maybe even sort of a, emo or maybe a thespian sort of crowd.
Please don't put emo and thespian in the same crowd and, and lump them together as if that was one group.
That's what I'm talking about. That's the tragedy, Adam.
So, I mean, yeah, maybe even the mainstream could broaden the demographic a little bit. I got to agree. I don't see that saving the industry, because I think at its heart, a role-playing game is still a role-playing game. And it's always going to carry a certain stigma, and it is always going to appeal only to a certain kind of person because of that. And yeah, you may push the demographic out a little bit, but I don't know that you're going to...
Well, all right. Let's take this back a couple years. What made Battletech draw people in and keep them? I mean, because the only thing that seems to have changed is we've just moved to a fad type business.
The thing is
model.
With Battletech is that they didn't do any one thing to draw people in. They slowly, over the course of 20 years, built up a fan base that just grew and grew and grew.
So why not start that now?
Because, like you said and John said, industry doesn't want to do that. They want to have that hot pop. They want to have that hit and sell their 10 million units and then wonder why nobody's buying anything at the end of the fad.
Oh, I don't think they wonder.
I don't think so.
No, I think they know.
I think they're thinking of the next pop.
Yeah.
You know,
how depressing. Do you think that industries, when they created games, need to have more of a fan feedback, almost a forum? Like, with our games...
Yes.
With the podcast series and the forum, we bring the creation of the game. Like, people are going step by step with us as we create this game. Do you think that would help things?
Big, huge yes. I mean, does that save the industry? I don't know. It's probably an answer that's bigger than that. But I think that would have saved them from a lot of this. Because going back to that FAFSA thing, where there were several of us that were kind of their most vocal fan base people that were saying to them, look, what are you guys doing? And they didn't want to hear it. I mean, they just would not hear a word we were saying. I think, yeah, you got to know the people that are spending their money on this. Let's go back to the Privateer Press thing. What really is the most powerful resource Privateer Press has?
Word of mouth.
Exactly.
You should see the feral fans in the war machine forum.
It does not have fans. It has missionaries.
Yeah, that's
true. And, you know,
I've heard stories of people buying out of their own pockets to start new gamers up.
Yeah.
And that's something, man, I tell you, you can't buy something like that. You've got to have the fans involved. And that's something I hope we can do with Skies of Glass, is we can really have a community that is involved in this. Now, you can't necessarily let...
You can't just say, community, go.
Well,
it
right,
has
yeah,
to be
well,
something
the,
that
the
they draw
Private
into.
Your Press... I don't want to say drives it, but they are wholly supportive of
that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And
exactly.
they give a direction,
whereas,
too.
Whereas, like, Games Workshop closes down their forums and isolates themselves and pushes their community out, Privateer Press does the opposite. They open it up, and they draw the community in, and they, you know, it's different. And you can see
exactly.
the difference in the community.
And there's a line between that and open source gaming. Really.
Right.
And I'm not advocating that, because you can't please everybody.
Yeah. And even, what's this? Who wrote this article?
Ryan Dancy.
Even he says that Privateer Press is one of the people that he sees making money this year. Mm-hmm. But even then, he filters that through his negativity. He's like, yeah, but they'll probably screw it up somehow.
Yeah, because this whole article is very, very negative.
It's depressing.
Yeah, and I don't take quite as grim of an outlook as he does. Because
it's an apocalyptic look at the gaming industry.
Well,
I mean,
you know, if you put one out every year, you're going to be right sometime.
Yeah.
That's true.
Well, you know, and the thing about gaming is this. You have to be honest about the fact that, like comic books, the industry definitely has problems right now, but gaming is still one of those staple forms of entertainment that I don't see just disappearing and
right.
fading out, just like comic books. Even though comic books has been in a pit for, two decades now?
Yeah.
It's hardly gone away. There are still comic shops out there and still tons of people that are into comics and tons of fan following for comics. And I see role-playing games the same way. This is just a storm. And what gets the industry through this is if the industry has the sense to understand, look, this is what draws in and keeps gamers, not even necessarily new people, but just your existing gamers. This is what gets them excited about their hobby. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it's going to spread. And that's something I hope we can do with Skies of Glass, is, you know, not try and make any radical, weird breakthroughs, not try to find that magic bullet, but just make something that's quality, that's interesting that has an active community, and then just let nature take its course slowly but surely and see where it goes from there. The design topic for today.
What? We have a design topic?
We do.
I thought we were going to talk about this for
we
an
probably,
hour.
You know what? I could be wrong here, and I don't want to make any promises, but this is a subject that kind of we've just started thinking about, and like even our thoughts on it are not fully mature.
Yeah, this having been developed during the course of this podcast.
Yeah, well, exactly. I could see like even tonight after we shut off the mics that I'm like, you know what? I was wrong. I think maybe it's more like this.
Oh, that means we're going to have to re-record.
No, I don't see us re-recording. No. I think what we did was great. What I foresee happening.
We haven't even done it yet. And he's like, what we have done is great.
What I foresee.
I agree.
What I foresee happening is I hope this generates a fair amount of good conversation on the forums, and some people that are more interested in following the current industry than we do will throw out some things we hadn't thought about, at which
like
point
fact
yes at which yeah. point we may go back and revisit the subject,
yeah,
possibly the next episode. Actually, we may have a special guest here next episode.
Oh, I think we might.
I love how you say we may possibly have, so, as if these things aren't in stone.
He would actually do a really good job of adding this conversation. So
it's
maybe
Andrew Jackson, isn't it?
It's Andrew Jackson and Kevin Symbieta.
Yes.
They're both going to be here. And Don Shadowrun.
Don
Shadow. Is Andrew Jackson related to Steve Jackson? Because if he's responsible for Illuminati, I'm going to bust his face in.
No, Andrew Jackson. You know,
yeah, I know,
the U.S. president,
yeah.
Star of the Democratic Party. Gotcha.
There was no way he was a Democrat. Was he really?
He started the Democratic Party.
I need to reread.
Well,
AP out of U.S. history for my major.
Also,
I should have actually taken the course.
I can give you a great biography.
Well, between Civil War and today, there's also been a big shift in the politics of parties.
Oh, well, yeah. Multiple times. Right. Well,
anywho.
It's fear the boot, not fear the history.
Right.
I can do a whole podcast.
What I foresee is us coming back to this topic again, either possibly next episode or maybe in a bonus episode.
We'll do it in the future. We'll probably do it, assuming we go another year, we'll probably do this and look back. Maybe an end-of-the-year review.
We could.
I know we could.
What's wrong with Ryan Dancy? We'd have like a whole end-of-the-year.
Or, you know what? If things come to fruition, what's right about Ryan Dancy?
Why we're out of a podcast. Signing off. This is Fear the Boot. Ryan Dancy was right.
Thanks. We have just been purchased by Galoob.
Check out next the customer.
What are you
going to
do with your $5?
Buy a booster pack.
Design topic for today.
Yes.
All right. We are in the last of the what we are calling the soft subjects of game design. Starting next episode, we are going to be raw and ready for
killing
rules. Well, not say killing, but just all the things involved in
farming,
rules.
Damage rolls.
Turnips.
Farming and fishing.
Roll D15,000 for your boll weevil count.
Then go kill them with your nines.
I rolled locusts.
Oops.
All right, so the last of the soft subjects we want to talk about today is art. And art is going to be an interesting subject for us to cover because
I'm not an artist.
Yeah, there's not a single artist
sitting
at the
table. Yeah, none of us are informed on this topic at all. So,
but we can
not
talk
that
about
changes things.
We can pontificate wildly.
You know
about
what? We can talk about what we don't like in role playing game art, and
which
we can talk about
what we do,
what we do like.
Here's
in
the point:
game art.
I have before had conversations regarding art with people that are artists, and they're like, "Well, you don't get this or that because you're not an artist." And it's like, "No, I'm something more important than an artist.
I'm an art consumer,
and as a consumer, I can hold something in my hands and say, you know what, I like this and I would pay for it.
I would like it enough to buy it,
right,
or I don't like it enough
so,
to buy it.
While,
that doesn't mean it's good or bad.
You know, starving artist isn't a phrase that came from nowhere.
Yeah.
So while I sit here and fully admit that I do not know all the ins and outs of different mediums and methods and art theories, that's not the approach we're going to take. We are going to talk about this from the standpoint of someone who is trying to create a solid whole totality of a product, and then also someone who is, of course, a consumer of the art. So that's the approach we're going to take. All right, so let's start by talking about what the purpose of art is within your role-playing game.
To employ Keith Curtis.
Sexual tantalization.
With Keith Curtis?
Okay, I hope it's...
Well, you know.
Every day, whoa, he changes his avatar on the forum and adds more animation to it. Now it grows a mullet.
Do you know what his current avatar is?
That's my prediction for 2007. Keith Curtis's avatar is going to have an artificial intelligence and think.
There's this guy on our forums named Keith Curtis, and he does art for role-playing games and things like that.
Champions, wasn't it?
Yeah. His avatar is an animated GIF, I think, and it's a sketch, a self-portrait of himself as sketching it. But he changed it, and now it flips to a self-portrait of himself, flipping to each of the X-Men characters. His hair flips back like Wolverine. He turns blue like Nightcrawler. His eyes glow like Cyclops. His skin turns metal like Colossus.
Oh,
yes, totally, it's all X-Men characters. That's so cool.
I didn't catch that.
Yeah.
I didn't get that either.
Yeah. Oh, it's so neat.
Of course, I normally check the forums over remote desktop, so things like that are really slow.
Yeah,
so
you'd probably get like one frame.
I just don't like art.
I just thought it was like his hair blowing in the wind. I didn't catch all
the Cyclops one, because Keith wears glasses.
Right.
It doesn't even do Cyclops glasses. His glasses just glow.
That's awesome.
It is very clever.
But Keith's most important contribution to the art world, of course, is he drew Baron Von Badass.
Yes, he did.
And did he draw Baron Von Badass?
Where's the t-shirts?
I actually have an email sitting there from the guys at Geek Label that I haven't got.
Oh, and this is our design. This is us fluffing around our design topic,
right,
by the way.
Yeah, so I need to open that up, and I'll give an update on that hopefully next episode or post something on the forums. But
I'm tired of people asking me about it.
Okay, well, I'm going to find out. I actually did find out about it. I just haven't opened the email yet because I've been distracted by other things.
Like a podcast.
That we're not doing. So the purpose of art outside of employing Keith Curtis for sexual tantalization, which was a transition I didn't quite feel comfortable with.
I didn't reference Chad's point. I referenced yours. C harkened back to A, not to B.
All right.
All right, let's talk about this art.
All right, so what is the purpose of art within a role-playing game?
To convey feel.
Nah, we used that one last time. Let's go with something new.
It's convey feel.
Completely 100% right. I would say it also has one other purpose. Convey feel is probably the most important one. The other one is...
We're talking about just the art, right? We're not talking about the diagrams, like the grenade scatter diagram would not be considered art.
Maybe, but
it's beautiful in its own right.
Because that's not art. That's not conveying feel. That's conveying rules.
I would say there is one other purpose of art, which is to convey appearance. For example, let's say that our role playing game, which it will, introduces some kind of weird or unusual object. Now, part of a role playing game is the fact that the whole thing occurs in your imagination. And everyone thinks a little differently, but most people have at least some element of visualization going on in their head. So this helps to kind of give you a picture, literally, mm-hmm. of what something looks like. And this could be a weapon, a creature, a type of armor, a kind of dress or clothing, yeah. a city, a landscape.
A perfect example of that is if you're doing a sci-fi future space role-playing game, you need pictures of the aliens.
Yeah, very much so.
Simple questions
like, okay, you've got the science scanner. Here comes the guard. Okay, I hide it. Well, everyone looks around. Would that even fit in your shirt?
Yeah. Is this a tablet PC? Is this like something off of Star Trek?
Is this
Trek,
like a big push cart? Which we had this happen to us in a game once where we were carrying around a kit thinking it was a toolbox. Found out later it was like a half-ton
portable
crate
to do it. Yeah.
So,
because the description, it was a toolkit.
Right.
Tools, toolkit. At the very least, it has wheels. No.
It was the Black Mesa interdimensional push cart thing that Gordon uses his MIT degree to move around.
It is the cursed chair.
Yeah, thanks, John.
You guys suck.
Time for you to go back to sleep over there, buddy. Oh, don't worry. It'll be misattributed to me.
No, yeah, that's right. It is. You suck, Adam. You just crashed the podcast.
So,
the second thing I would say it does is it helps convey the appearance of something. And in this, that being the case, you would probably want to be sure to focus your art in ways that convey feel or that illustrate unusual elements of setting within your role-playing game.
How does it go wrong?
Where does art go wrong? A couple things.
Oh, more than a couple.
First of all, the art is inaccurate.
That was just funny.
I've seen anatomically inaccurate art.
Well, I've seen lots of it.
Like in a role-playing game.
For the purpose that I outlined earlier.
But you have to understand that the art is not just pretty stuff to break up the text. Mm-hmm. Because people are using this to visualize elements of your setting, as we just said.
Not necessarily what does that gun look like, but just what is the world
look
like?
Yeah, if you are way off on something, that you have the scale of something's all wrong or the appearance of something's all wrong, this really does mess up someone's understanding of the role-playing game.
Mm-hmm.
Irrelevance.
Irrelevance is a hard one, because what we're talking about with irrelevance is you have the chapter on grenades, and this is how grenades scatter, and this is how they do the damage, and this is how the this and that, and then you have a picture of somebody sitting there fishing. Do you, I mean, it's, when you say it, it sounds ridiculous, but really, do you have to have a picture of a grenade in the grenade section, or do you just want to have a random picture that can, that still conveys the feel of the story?
I realize, yeah, there's also kind of, this is sort of a fine line you got to walk here, because like you were saying, I don't think you need to take this to its nth degree where every single picture corresponds to whatever text is right by it. I mean, that could create some really bizarre, I mean, like, what do you show for character creation? A fetus? You know, this is going to create some really unusual things. But on the flip side, you're going through the role-playing book, and you're, like, in the equipment section. They're talking about these weird alien devices, and next to it is a picture of a dude brushing his teeth.
Yeah.
It's like, what am I going to do with this? I mean, this doesn't help me. So you may want to try and, I guess at any rate, at least keep it relevant to the game, even if it's not relevant to the rules that's right
even
by.
Even if it's out of place, if it's accurate to your game world, you can't really say it failed in the objective of conveying feel. It just was a little weird.
Mm-hmm.
Something else I don't like about some art and role-playing games is uselessness.
Yeah.
And what
uselessness.
I mean, well, hear me out on this one. If you have art, and once again, define it as conveying feel or conveying setting, and you have art, and I'm not just talking like a picture of a guy with a gun, but if like every single picture from cover to cover is just some hard-ass, badass guy rippling muscles in a wife beater, gritting his teeth with a giant machine gun in each hand, and some half-naked chick behind him.
Riffs.
And fill the role-playing game. Yeah, that's what I was about to say.
And this is everything you see from front to back. The art has taught you nothing.
Yeah.
And the art is part...
The art has taught you that everybody in this game has a gun and a hot chick.
And apparently a really good dentist. But it's, you know, the art is just from cover to cover was useless. It, once again, I'm not saying that...
Unless your game is about... unless it's a hard-ass game where you're playing, you know, ripped supermen doing super stuff with hot chicks. I mean, there's games out there like that and for that.
You know, I remember Sam Chupp, and we talked about this voicemail a couple episodes ago, sent us in a voicemail talking about the difficulty of keeping the artists on the same page as the people that are doing the creation of the role-playing. He's talking about how they would send them a field document, and sometimes the artists wouldn't really understand it because they're detached from the creative process. Sometimes they would outright ignore it and just send in stuff, or they would even take it too literally. I realize this isn't always possible in a lot of settings because, especially at a corporation, you may just be having assignments and departments and contractors and whatever. But for us, I hope we can really have the artists involved in the creative process, where it's not just people we just kind of like send a brief note to, but these are people instead where we really help them to understand what it is we're trying to create and walk them through the setting and all the ins and outs of the role-playing game and find people that are not just interested in doing the art but are really genuinely excited about the product itself.
Yeah, well, it's always a little jarring when, like, even when you're not gaming, when you're just reading a book and the cover art, it's very apparent that they just paid some guy to draw a picture and this has nothing to do with anything, and you think it's dumb.
Well, I think like a gaming group, there's going to be some sort of in-depth interview process. Like, you really need to find out if this person is going to be invested in the project or is just trying to get stuff out there.
That's why I think an indie game could have really good art. Well, it's going to have really bad art, and at the same time, it's going to have really good art. It's going to have really bad art because nobody has any money. Nobody can actually afford to hire somebody with talent. But on the other hand, the talentless jerk-off that you're actually working with, you can go and have a beer with him and say, hey, this is what I'm feeling, this is what I'm not.
It's also possible that you have someone in there that's an artist who just hasn't done much with that art,
right. But
feels really invested in this product.
If they feel invested, A+.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen some indie games that do have.
So have I.
I agree with you, Chad. I've seen some that has chicken scratch art. But I've also seen some that really do have outstanding art because whoever it was, to them this was not likely just a job.
Right.
That this was something that they just felt passionate about.
That kind of gets me thinking, okay, say you're designing a role-playing game. And it's an indie game, and you're not exactly you. And you're not some big company, and you have a day job.
I'm with you.
And you're broke, basically.
I can relate.
I can check that one.
Yeah. But you're doing a role-playing game, and you need art. What do you do?
Start a podcast.
Yes.
And then fish through your listeners.
Promise them a t-shirt.
Well, you know, I guess you got a couple options. One is to start checking your social network, asking friends, friends of friends. If you keep an online blog or live journal or whatever, post something on there. You're looking for artists. Hunt if you've got a local university. Sometimes you can go there and post something on the tack board in their art department saying, hey, looking for artists that are willing to help me for minimal money but some amount of exposure.
Yeah, there's a lot of art majors out there. I'm the one currently attending college among us, and they like work.
I think. Well, and you know what? If you're just trying to start out in your career, you're an art major or something like that, you're trying to build a portfolio.
Right.
Wow. You know, and if this is something a little bit more than just a among friends game, something that could get published, that's just something else you could put in your portfolio.
And even art that isn't just for art's sake has a different feel.
Right.
Because when you, like, if you were to apply for a marketing job, I'm sure they're looking for things where you actually took a subject and arted that subject.
Yeah, I guess once again, you got to find people that are invested in the project, though. Because, like, as we're doing Skies of Glass, if an artist came to us and said, hey, I'd love to work with you guys, we'd have to tell this person up front, look, we have no money to pay you.
Yeah.
You know, we might at some point in the future, but as it stands right now, this is purely a labor of love.
We've already told a couple of people that who expressed interest in the project. It's like, there will never be any money in this.
I guess something else you can do is start being resourceful. This is something that we have kicked around for Skies of Glass, is we want to convey, we go back to our field, what do we say in our field? Well, we want to convey a lot of realism to this, draw people in, make them kind of see this as their own world. As we look through our lives, we don't have access to a lot of artists. But what we do have access to is
We do have access to a lot of artists, just none that produce art.
Well, yeah. This is actually another problem. Chad and I have tried several projects in the past, and I can think of one where the roles were reversed, but in almost everything we did, we'd be pumping out the writing, and we just could not get those damn artists to give us a finished drawing. I mean, you could stick a gun to their head, and there was no finished drawing coming out.
Oh, you can't force art.
Oh, yeah, Oprah's on.
You know, your deadlines don't mean anything to me.
Yeah. However bad you writers out there may have production anxiety, for artists, it is genetic. And God bless the artists out there that actually finish drawings, because there aren't many of you.
You guys wearing ties. Your lives are so hurried.
The artists who actually like finish their work and make a living at it, we don't call them artists. We call them professionals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that are flipping around. The ones that don't produce, we don't call artists.
Yeah, but, exactly.
Is a man who never writes a book the world's greatest novelist? Mm-hmm. And similarly, is a man who never finishes a drawing an artist?
It's like Dawn always used to say. We had a friend, Paul. Her ex-boyfriend was a quote-unquote artist.
He's damn good when he drew.
And
damn good when
he drew. We would say that. We'd say, wow, he has a lot of talent and he's really good. And she would always say, no, he's a horrible artist because he never finishes anything.
But getting back to the resourceful comment, when we looked around, looked at our field, looked at what we had access to, we didn't have access to many artists. What we do know is a bunch of really good photographers. Mm-hmm. For those of you that don't know much about St. Louis, when you see all those horrible statistics about how St. Louis is a depressed, run-down, crime-ridden town, what they're talking about is they're talking about downtown. Because everyone in St. Louis, for the most part, lives in the suburbs, which are nice and middle to upper class. But because downtown is, we have effectively this abandoned industrial park, which is our city, we have a great place to go and take all kinds of pictures that would wonderfully convey post-nuke civilization.
Yeah.
If we don't get shot in the process.
So we'll be fine.
What we are considering doing is moving away from the typical medium that RPG art is done in, which is ink work or pencil and ink
illustrations
work, and moving instead to see what we can do with photography. Now, granted, there are some things you can't photograph. We talk about the GCs or the genetic constructs in our setting documents. Mm-hmm. There are none of those for me to take a picture of or anyone to take a picture of. So we are going to have to get some illustration done But we think there's a lot of the stuff in the book we want to convey that we can do with a combination of a digital camera and some Photoshop know-how. I see art being one of the subjects that we may come back and revisit a little bit. I don't see us doing a whole nother episode on it. But there are some people that I would love to try and get on Skype, at least for like a bonus episode, to talk more about like the different mediums or all the stories they have from actually working in the big name gaming industry companies about things that went on with art. Because really the way that we have approached this subject was, as we said earlier, from a consumer standpoint, but also from the standpoint of someone who's trying to do this game on zero budget from their basement, which is going to be a different experience than people that are working for some big company trying to get this thing done. So I would love to see us revisit this a little more with some really informed guests at some point in the hopefully not too distant future, not like next episode or anything, but sometime in the near future.
Our super secret ninja guest is next episode.
That's right.
Oh, that's very true.
We have Batman coming.
Shh.
He'll kill you.
Skies of Glass Q&A for this episode. We got a couple questions here that were all asked by our good friend Dan Perez, who is involved with, and I believe actually owns, or...
Or the his highly accurate forum title of High Moon Media.
That's his forum name. And he's involved in High Moon Media Productions. He also is the guy that does the Gamer Traveler podcast. I think he does.
I'm sure he'll post.
He's
going to
correct us.
And
so
I think he's already had to correct us on some of these points.
Hi, Dan.
He's also the Gamer Traveler guy for the Gamer Traveler podcast, which is a great show where he just goes around the world to all these really neat places, talking about them from a gamer's perspective.
Yeah, so traveling gamer, man after my own heart.
We have alluded to his show on numerous occasions. All right, so he asked a whole slew of questions that I'm going to try and work through. The first thing he said was he noted a quote from our own setting document that said, perhaps the most unusual technology to come from the resource wars was the creation of genetically modified animals for use in a wide variety of industrial and transportation roles, capable of matching the performance of the machines that had once replaced their natural-born ancestors. And to this quote, he responds by saying, I thought you said there'd be no mutants. All right, so let me kind of unpack that a little bit.
No, my mutant comment comes back to bite me in the ass.
It does.
Again.
Mm-hmm. Once again, Adam has ruined the show.
It's okay, it'll be attributed to John.
Okay, once again, John has ruined the show. When we said there were no mutants, we were talking about this in the sense that we're forbidding certain kinds of mutants. Now, I realize in the most literal sense of the word, the GCs, and if you don't know what a GC is, go out to the resource section on feartheboot.com and read our setting documents. But the GCs are genetically modified animals, and therefore they are, I guess, in the most literal sense of the word, a form of a mutant because they were created through the mutation of their genetics. But that's not the kind of mutant we were getting at.
We were talking more of the colloquial mutants.
We were talking about Wolverine and Cyclops.
Well, we were talking about the things that just do not really make any good scientific sense.
Blasted with radiation, now you have wings at work.
Yeah. Somehow, body rotting radiation made you better. So, once again, to clarify, Adams, there will be no mutants comment was, he was painting with an overly broad brush. We mean there will be no mutants in the X-Men or the wasteland sense of the word. Not that there will be nothing in the game that has been modified
genetically.
We're
going to have this discussion again,
but, you know,
with the red-haired people.
Something I am specifically trying to get away from, though, is there will be nothing mutated in this game outside of degenerative radiation that will be human, humanoid, or possessing of human intellect. There will be no fish people. There will be no cows that you can converse with. So even in the GCs, there's limits
people
on them. Adam, could you forward him some?
Yes. No, okay, never mind, we're fine.
All right, next question he asks is, he asks about the whole thing with Reno Howler. Once again, if you don't know what he's talking about, this would be in our history document, and says, because in there I'm fairly vague about exactly what caused the nukes to be launched, and he was mentioning that he would love to play a story, and at some point in the future would love to be able to know exactly what happened. And to answer that, we do indeed have in mind a particular conspiracy and series of events that led up to the world being nuked. We left it vague there because that will give us some opportunities in the future to develop this in the form of an adventure module or a novel or whatever later on. But we do have those events lined out, and we do intend to expose those events to the public at some point further on down the road.
We also kind of wanted to keep it vague so that when you, if you go from town to town, people you encounter have wildly ranging different views on how and why and what happened. Your characters will have wildly ranging different
views. Yeah, and that's, a lot of this game is perspective.
Yeah, it comes down to the people in the game don't really know what happened.
Right. And I think if we were to tell them too early, we would break the feel of our own game. Because, you know, while this wasn't mentioned in the field document, we want there to be sort of a confusion because the mass media is gone. Investigative reporters can't tell anyone anything. The world got nuked. Most of what you have to go off of is those last few hours before the broadcast stations went off, followed by a whole lot of speculation and rumor and people kind of wandering around who may have some tidbit of the story. Imagine if we were playing a role-playing game of the Titanic and everyone has to act like they don't know the ship's going to sink. You will. I mean, you can do your best, and you may even do a good job of RPing it.
I bring 6 life vests.
Yeah, or that first time we're in the middle of the night, someone's like, the boat shakes suddenly and bits of ice fall onto the deck. You know what's going to happen, and it's very hard, at least on a subconscious level, to not play that somehow. So we want to create this kind of sense of wonderment and confusion that I don't think we could do if we told everyone up front exactly why this happened and what all is out there. The last question he asks us, and this is a popular question, is did Place X get nuked? And his question is specifically Puerto Rico, and the answer is I don't honestly know. After we finish working out North America, we are going to move fairly quickly towards places like the Caribbean, the Gulf of Mexico.
Europe.
Yeah, Europe. And so at that point, we will let you know. I actually have some development ideas for Cuba, which would probably affect Puerto Rico, but we haven't worked them out in enough detail to really tell you yet.
The littler islands might be under the ocean now. I mean, if all this melting ice cap crap actually goes down, they're gone.
You're asking the wrong guy. Actually, what it boils down to, Dan. Yes, Chad, he'll just nuke it.
Yeah. I have an official forum policy. When anybody ever asks me, does my hometown get nuked? Does such and such a town get nuked? The answer is always and every time, yes, it does.
Chad, does Pluto get nuked?
Yes, it does, Dan.
Is this getting further demoted from non-planet status into
to nuked non-planet?
Amazingly, it gets nuked and it gets pushed further in line and in
and
orbit.
And it becomes a planet again.
Yes. Yes, it does.
And you know where it ends up?
Where?
Uranus.
Oh.
Okay. That's totally beneath me, Dan.
Now that we've made an anus joke, it's a complete episode of Fear the Boot. So, Dan, if you would do the closing monologue.
So, thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
Uranus?
Yes, my anus.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot. This show is copyright 2007, fully owned by its host. The games, movies, and other properties mentioned in the show are the property of their respective owners. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to FearTheBoot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at FearTheBoot.com.